This podcast is brought to you by IFR Magazine. Hello, this is Jeff Van West, and I'm talking with Pat Patton, director of the Flying Medical Service in Tanzania. Now, Tanzania, we're talking about East Africa here, just south of Kenya, is that correct?
That's correct. It's a huge country, about 365,000 square miles, about the size of Texas and Oklahoma put together.
And the Flying Medical Service, just to give us a sense of scale here, how many people are you on staff and what kind of aircraft?
Well, we're a very small organization, but we work with lots of people in the field. We have two aircraft and we're four pilots. All the pilots are also paramedics, field trained, and we have volunteer nurses and doctors at local hospitals that we can access.
And what kind of aircraft are they?
They're Cessna 206s.
And how many people do you serve, Pat, as part of the Flying Medical Service?
I think last year we saw about 22,000 patients. We're very few, but the way the work is organized, we get to see quite a few people who otherwise wouldn't have any other access to healthcare.
Now, one of the things in our email correspondence that intrigued me, you said it's often VFR there, but you actually also are flying IFR at times in basically uncontrolled airspace, something fairly foreign to U.S. pilots. Can you describe how that works?
It works wonderfully, and I think if people haven't done it, it's probably a little difficult to imagine what goes on. It's very safe, and one of the reasons that it is so safe is we probably have fewer than 100 aircraft operating in the country. And all the pilots are talking on a common frequency. We use 118.2, and any aircraft within any danger of running into you is also talking with you. We can arrange our own flight levels and maintain separation that way. There is contact with air traffic control in certain circumstances, but in many parts of the country, I would say most parts of the country, especially at lower levels, you can't get air traffic control on VHF. There is a possibility to do it on HF radio, but it's pretty cumbersome, and the HF frequencies serve all of Eastern Africa, so they can be very, very congested. So pretty much you take off. If you take off in uncontrolled airspace and you're landing in uncontrolled airspace, you wouldn't be talking with anyone other than broadcasting your own position and intentions. And if you had air traffic control involved, generally what you hear back from them is they would say no known traffic at flight level 110. Call again in 30 minutes.
And so the air traffic control you're talking about, just for clarity here, this is non-radar air traffic control. They can't see you. They're just tracking your flight.
That's right. It really brings back the whole notion of mandatory reporting points. This kind of thing is more important in a non-radar environment, and most of Tanzania is non-radar. It's only a relatively small area, say within 80, 90 miles of Dar es Salaam, the capital, or the commercial capital anyway, that's covered by radar.
And also, just to be clear here, you're telling me that the entire country and all the airports are all on one frequency. Is that correct?
No. The entire country, there's a common air-to-air frequency, which all the pilots would be monitoring, and there are very few controlled facilities in the country. I think we have towers only in Dar es Salaam, the commercial capital, in Dodoma, the political capital, at Kilimanjaro, and at Mwanza by Lake Victoria. And we have advisory services at airports like Arusha, Kigoma, but these are places that some of the places wouldn't have even one flight a day. Arusha, on the other hand, has quite a few.
Now, in terms of instrument approaches, since you have very few control towers, are there several approaches, or do you have your own procedures that you use to get yourself down to the airport?
Well, in most cases, in most parts of the country, we use our own procedures. So it's a matter just of getting below the cloud safely and doing a VFR approach. But there are IFR approaches to the major airports, and they have published NDB approaches, VOR, and some GPS approaches.
In terms of your own methods for getting down to the airport, how do you develop something like that?
Well, it's really important to know the area that you're flying in. There are things that you can do safely in areas where you're very familiar with the weather, and where also you might be where you might have high frequency radio access to a doctor or a nurse at a hospital. Very often, during the rainy seasons, especially the weather around Arusha Airport, which is where we're based in north central Tanzania, the weather can be right down to the ground. But there's no problem getting out of there. The problem is coming back in. It's because of the terrain. But we know that in 2 minutes we're above the clouds and we can go just about anywhere we want. Then knowing how the terrain holds or doesn't hold the clouds will determine whether you can safely do a flight at that time of day to a given place. I know if I go 100 miles west, it will always be clear, even during the rainy season. And so it's just a matter of flying on top of this and coming out at the other end, VFR.
How do you handle alternates in Tanzania?
Very carefully. The one issue is, for a magazine that's based in the United States, you're dealing with temperate zone weather. We're dealing with tropical weather, which is cellular weather. It's not frontal weather. So if the weather is bad in one place, you know that you can get to a place that has decent weather in a relatively short time. I've been flying out there for 36 years, and I don't think that ever an alternate has ever seriously been an issue.
And what do you do about weather reporting so that you have a sense of what the weather's going to be like when you get to some of these outlying airports?
Well, if you're the first pilot up, you start giving information to other pilots who ask you. If you are the first pilot up, then you're pretty much on your own. There is weather reporting at several stations in the country, and they do a good job. Sometimes access to that weather is difficult. Phone lines can be down. But you can also access the weather by HF radio at different stations. They monitor HF radio. The issue is not really so much the difficult weather. You can almost always go, and then you avoid thunderstorms. We have our aircraft equipped with storm scopes and three-dimensional GPS, the KLN-94 with a King KMD-250 moving map display. But it's it displays in according to your altitude in three dimensions, so it makes it very good for getting around 20,000-foot mountains.
What's a typical day like for you in the flying service?
We have regular fixed flights. Our main work is doing regularly scheduled clinics, but all kinds of stuff happens in between those. So I have a radio call at 8 o'clock in the morning. I listen to several high-frequency radios, and only for 5 minutes. So any hospital in the whole of Eastern Africa could call in on those radio frequencies if telephone access wasn't available. And they could say, we have a problem here. Can you make any suggestions, or can you get this plane, can you get this patient out or a doctor in? And we do that at 8 o'clock in the morning, 12 noon, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and 8 o'clock in the evening. So it's not solid coverage, but it's pretty much throughout the day that people can contact with us within a reasonable time. And then we always have one plane out on clinics. So we have about 30 different places that we go to every 2 weeks. So on a given day at a given time, the airplane is in that particular village, and people know for miles and miles around. And sometimes we get people carried on a stretcher for 60 kilometers, and then in order to meet the plane. So it's very important that we keep a tight schedule. On the other hand, the air ambulance service part of the operation is, you can't predict it at all. We average about one emergency every 2 to 3 days.
What about night flying or just airport lighting in general to help guide you to the airport in low visibility? Is there anything at these outlying airports? What's it like?
It's real interesting and real challenging, and we tend to avoid bush takeoffs and landings at night unless it's nearly certain that the patient wouldn't survive till the morning. The reason is not so much because of the flying. The problem is is getting out of the place. And getting on the ground is not nearly as much of a problem as getting out. If you do a set of lights, just put a set of flashlights on the ground along the left side of the runway, you can pretty much accurately gauge where you need to land, and you tend to stop much quicker than you normally would because the ends look much closer than they really are. But the problem is with animals wandering in front of the lights. So you would turn on a landing light only at the last second, and takeoff is the most dangerous because you really have to have the landing light on, and animals can run in front of it. So we
the landing light actually attracts animals?
Yes, that's right. It's like, well, here in the States, there's a lot of accidents with deer at night. The deer runs in front of the car and just freezes there. And the same thing can happen with an airplane. And instead of a deer, it could be an elephant or a giraffe or a large gazelle. Even a small gazelle will ruin your day.
What were some of the more challenging days that you've had, or more challenging events while flying?
There's always challenges, and they're very, very different. Once I got a telephone call after sunset, and I was asked to go to a major city in western Tanzania, and they do have airport lights there, but the airport was closed, and I asked people, well, could they find someone from the control tower, and would they be able to get the lights on by 10 o'clock at night? And they said, yeah, they could. So I got on a motorcycle, went to the airport. It takes about 15 minutes from where I live to the airport. Got the airplane configured, and when I got in the pilot seat, I realized that one of the other pilots had pulled the GPS out to do some programming. And so I wound up taking off out of there at night and flying 270 miles to the west just on watch and compass. And then at that time, the VOR wasn't working there, so I was able to see the city lights, and I knew that the airport was a little bit off to the side of the city, so was able to talk with the tower then and ask them if they could turn on the lights, and did the landing okay. And then out of there was the reverse. We had to wait some hours actually for the patient to get there. They were still struggling over muddy, bumpy roads, and probably got out of there at 1 o'clock in the morning. And the guys in the tower had gone home. They called us back, or we called them back. They were very, very cooperative. And once I had taken off and gotten about 2 or 3 minutes out, they said, well, you all set? And I said, yes. And they turned off the lights, and it's just completely black except for an occasional bushfire from there all the way to Nairobi, another 285 miles. And there's a mountain that blocks the VOR from there, so I knew that I wouldn't be able to get a VOR until I was within, say, 30, 40 miles of Nairobi. So you just go at night, watch and compass. That was a particularly bad night with lots of weather. So you avoid the area with the heaviest lightning flashes, and you go. And you know that you're going to get there. It's somehow not the way it sounds. It's very beautiful flying, very interesting flying, and except for the patient who's suffering on board, it's like nothing I've ever done in the States. An African night is really dark. One of the real interesting things is you can often do things that I've never heard people doing here in the States. There will be like a 20,000 foot mountain in the area, and the minimum sector altitude is way above that, but you have to approach to an airport that's 5,500 feet, and you just say, I'll maintain my own terrain clearance, and they'll let you do pretty much what you want to do. I've had several times where another pilot came on, a new pilot, upset at Kilimanjaro Tower, and said, you just cleared them westbound at 8,000 feet. And the tower says yes. And he says, well, you can't do that. The minimum sector altitude is 12,000 feet. And the tower says, yes, I'm aware of that. And he says, well, how can you do that? And he says, well, I just did it. He knows where he's going. What you learn to do is fall back on the resources that you learned when you first started to fly as a student pilot and a private pilot, and those are still the most important lessons. I mean, really, how to use a watch and a compass well. If the GPS goes out, to know that generally you can do the flight and can complete it without. It's a little bit more work in the cockpit, but that you can complete it on very basic instruments.
That's fascinating, Pat. Just a totally different world of flying from what we see here in the United States. One more thing, if someone wanted to find out more about the Flying Medical Service, how would they find out or how would they contact you?
We have a website, www.flyingmedicalservice.org. It's just all run together, Flying Medical Service. And I have an email address, FMS for Flying Medical Service, at bravooscarlima.charlieoscar.tangozulu.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Well, you're most welcome. And also, just to know that it's just a matter of getting used to it. It's not that anyone is we're really special pilots or anything. It's just a matter of getting used to it and learning how to do it safely.
This podcast has been brought to you by IFR Magazine. For more on IFR, log on to www.ifr-magazine.com.